In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
In the beginning, the IRS created the problem. Bear with me, we'll come back to that. Healthcare is not new. Ever since Adam and Eve got kicked out of the garden and mankind has been able to get sick or injured, we've needed healthcare. But what is new is how we pay for it, especially with the insertion of insurance into the mix, because practically nothing screws up free market transactions like deceiving you with how much something actually costs and who pays for it. While Adam and Eve and their kids didn't have health insurance, insurance in its basic form, a payment to hedge against possible losses, is not new. The Babylonians had rudimentary insurance for shipments. There's archaeological evidence in law tablets that enforced payments by an insurer that if you insured it, you had to pay it sort of thing. No trying to weasel out of paying. But health insurance is relatively new on the human stage. George Washington, or maybe it was John Adams, established an early benefit for soldiers that reimbursed them for medical expenses. But for most of the country, and for most of this country's history, there was no health insurance. If you got sick, you went to the doctor and paid for it yourself. If you couldn't afford it, well, you either didn't get health care beyond what your family or friends could give you, or you depended on charity, the doctor's charity usually, or help from your church or charitable organizations that were specifically set up to help in such times of need. In fact, many hospitals were specifically set up as charitable organizations. But as with most modern-day problems, the real problem stemmed from the government getting involved in the situation. It started in 1943 with a ruling by the IRS that set the stage for the skyrocketing costs of healthcare, and much of the corruption of our present-day healthcare market can be traced back to this ruling. In 1943, FDR was busily trying to convert America to a socialist nation. He was also fighting World War II. At the time, there were worker shortages due to World War II. Under normal circumstances, a company short on workers would simply increase the wages offered to attract new workers. But there were wage and price controls in effect during the war that prevented them from doing so. And of course, wage and price controls are a hallmark of socialism. To get around this, companies began to offer a package of benefits, including health insurance, as a means to attract new workers. And the IRS agreed to grant the incentives a tax-deductible status for employers and not to tax the benefits as income for employees. As a result, health insurance thus became a huge tax dodge for both employers and employees. It's important to stress here that the health care system is not in the state it is, nor costs what it does, due to a failure of the free market system. Obama and socialist marketers said and will continue to say things like, "We've tried the free market and it failed." Actually, no, you haven't. Today's healthcare and its current delivery model can hardly be considered a free market. In fact, it's anti-free market. In a free market system, communication about price is important. You buy a car or a mortgage, a house, you need to know all the costs. Not so in healthcare. The real cost is hidden from the consumer. In fact, that was one of the things Trump was trying to fix. Because most consumers don't directly pay for their own healthcare and many don't directly pay for their health insurance, it's a benefit, it distorts their perception of how much they actually pay for medical care or the true cost of healthcare. One researcher said for every dollar's worth of hospital care a patient consumes, that patient pays only about 3 cents out of pocket. The rest is paid by third-party coverages. Think about that. If a gallon of gas is $5, but you only paid 15 cents, would you really be overly concerned with how many miles per gallon your car got? Forget those expensive electric vehicles that take hours to charge and only go a couple hundred miles. I'm driving a big luxury gas hog all the way to New England. You see how the government can so easily distort and ruin a market economy? The healthcare market was further distorted by the passage in 1965 of Medicare and Medicaid. This is important because hospitals were reimbursed at the reasonable cost. Physicians were reimbursed at reasonable customary rates. But these reimbursement policies had already been inflationary since their start, originating in the 1930s, but cost overruns in Medicare and Medicaid soon became massive. One researcher said under these conditions, a hospital had a powerful incentive to increase its profit, not by decreasing their expenses, but by increasing costs to the consumer, which would then be reimbursed by the government. The hospital did better financially if it expanded its services and its facilities, regardless of the demand for them. And in all of this, not to mention the crushing effect thousands of regulations have on the healthcare market, which further drives up costs. And then along came Obamacare, which was passed because government interference had been poisoning the healthcare system, unnecessarily and artificially raising costs. So the leftist answer to any problem caused by government is even more government. And to sell it to people and politicians, they lied and used deceptive language. You know, pretty much what the serpent did to Eve way back when. Here's a general rule in life. If someone has to deceive you into it, it's not going to be good for you, but it will be good for them. And it was good for them. It has grown government exponentially, especially its control over you and so many other aspects of society. They promised and they lied. Free and lower costs, $1,200 savings, the free market system failed. But nothing has been free because it's not free when someone else is paying for it. Costs have not gone down. We are spending more than ever. I'm still waiting for my $1,200. And you can't blame the free market because we hadn't had a free market healthcare system since the government started interfering. Fast forward to today, in an Obamacare world, and even worse, what Oregon has with coordinated care organizations that, among other things, specifically created regional monopolies. The healthcare system, as we talked about last week, is spiraling out of control. Meanwhile, those in charge are desperately trying to do away with all competition and create a single-payer system, universal healthcare, a nationalized healthcare system. Whichever phrase they use, they want it 100% government-run and paid for. In short, they want us to have a system like they have in the United Kingdom. Because they say the free market has failed, it's really important for you to understand and to see how a normal market should work as opposed to what we're actually doing in healthcare. A free market system has the following characteristics. It recognizes private property. By definition, you must be able to own something in order to sell or buy it. There is communication on prices and services. Give me this much, you get that much. Competition on price, but also on services offered and convenience, which leads to innovation to cut costs to allow providers to cut their prices. Limited government interference, which should be limited to punish rule breakers and to ensure a level playing field. One of the most important features, for free markets to function, participants must have free choice among various options, and all buying and selling decisions must be voluntary, meaning you must have the freedom to choose whether or not to participate at all. Why? Because in a free market system, your threat, your decision not to buy something, is the single greatest driver, motivator, that pushes companies to cut prices. In freer industries, such as computers or shoes, there is no crisis. No crisis of affordability or quality, because people don't demand free computers or free shoes as a right that is then enforced by government decree. In true free market systems, prices and values are determined within the market by market participants. All of this is driven by price and value and competition. Buyers seek the lowest price for the highest value, while sellers compete with each other on price and perceived value, quality, convenience, design, ease of use, trust, and so on. Without an effective and efficient means to determine price and the value of a product or service, markets will eventually fail. Consumers will pay inflated prices while sellers will be unable to determine value for their customers. But, and this is the key, most healthcare consumers do not have true information about how much they are paying. That prevents the normal market force of consumers even bothering to seek better prices. But it's a two-way street. Healthcare providers also don't have access to information about what consumers want or would normally be willing to pay without the impacts of subsidies, insurance, and so forth. The net result is that consumers pay too much for services and providers can't accurately determine the value of the services they offer. People often misquote the Bible and say, "Money is the root of all evil." It's actually, "The love of money is the root of all evil." But money is definitely the root cause of so much of what is wrong with healthcare. And we'll talk about money and insurance and so much more as we continue our discussion from last week with Lisa Lettmeyer about the many crises in our healthcare system. Stay with us. She's up next. I'd like to welcome Lisa Lettmeyer back to the show. She is the owner of HealthSource Northwest, an independent insurance agency. She will help you sail the complex waters of health insurance and Medicare insurance throughout Oregon and Southwest Washington. Find out more at healthsourcenw.com. And Lisa, it's great to talk to you again.
You too. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, so, you know, with everything that we talked about last week, after the show, we said, you know, we really just kind of scratched the surface of all of the things that are going wrong right now with healthcare. So is there anything particular that you think we should talk about that we didn't get to last week?
I mean, I think last week I was really focusing on like the top three that I see, again, not being a healthcare provider, but just being somebody who helps people purchase insurance. Here's from providers who are retiring. Here's from carriers who are trying to pay these bills. So the top three we focused on last week was the cost of hospitalization, the cost of medications, and really kind of the out of control situation and cost with mental health crisis in our country right now. But there's plenty of other areas that push those costs up. Things such as the lack of tort reform. What that would be is some kind of caps on what you could get compensated for or sue for in the case you felt that, you know, there was not the appropriate outcome or with a medical procedure. And I always tell people, remember, our medical system is still a science, and nobody responds to any one given treatment or medication the same. They don't communicate the same. Their bodies don't react to the medications or the procedures. They don't maybe do the follow-up care the same. So there's lots of variables. And to just assume, oh, if something doesn't go my way, I'm immediately going to go to suing everybody involved and getting some astronomical costs. And we have to realize that that pushes into all of the costs of what we do.
Sure.
You know, on top of that, at least from what I hear and see again, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, that's just so typical of pretty much all of society right now is something goes wrong. I'm going to sue somebody. And, you know, we talked last week about we've kind of taken a vending machine approach to healthcare where we expect these instant fixes. And because we have put science on such a high pedestal that, of course, science can fix this. Of course, medical science can fix this. So clearly the doctor is screwed up. And you're right, if you talk to actual doctors, they'll tell you we have just barely scratched the surface when it comes to medical knowledge. In fact, a lot of what we do is just simple guesswork. So to hold these people to such extremely high standards, I think is just completely unfair.
Right. And it's not that I want to have medical professionals out there doing, you know, truly just negligent procedures. But at the same time, we need to be realistic. And we need to own our portion of it and understand that, again, chemicals, procedures, none of that is all the same within any given situation. There's all kinds of variables. But you've got that. You've got the fact that we really don't kind of deal in, at least here, and again, this is just these are all just my observations from everybody I talk to and things that I see, but we don't really deal with healthcare at a situation where, hey, what's going on and what can we truly do to change your course and live healthy? And that's lots of different things we could talk about. And I'm just as guilty. I live my you know, trans fats and chocolates and stuff like a lot of other people. However, what we really have become in this nation is a system of let's bring you in for those annual checkups. We know you're going to have, you know, one of the five or six big things going on in the world or the, you know, healthcare field: blood pressure, cholesterol, thyroid, diabetes, mental health, depression. So we're going to put you on a medication. It's going to take care of the symptoms and keep them kind of maintaining, and then check back in a year and we'll see if we need to add more to that. It's more of a maintenance situation than it really is a healthcare. And that inevitably leads to other issues too, because we're not really dealing with the root cause.
Yeah,
and again, there's no personal accountability.
Just to touch on what we said last week, it just seems like, you know, this is where drugs come into play. Is all of these commercials about drugs, and we've got a drug for this, we've got a drug for that, and so it just seems like, oh, they'll just hand us a pill, and that should be able to fix it. But you're right. So much of actual healthcare is ongoing healthcare. It's an everyday thing. It's not just, you know, when you have an emergency, but it's preventing those emergencies.
Right. And if you think about just, you know, any one of us who's going to the grocery store right now or filling up our gas tank, we have to understand that when cost of everything goes up around us, it affects our healthcare system too. Mm-hmm. So if they have to increase pay due to minimum wage increases, which then, you know, if they're paying somebody, you know, at $15 or $16 and all, you know, and they've been there for a couple of years and all of a sudden now everybody who gets hired is at that rate, then those people have to get an increase. Mm-hmm. And if it costs more for construction costs, if you're going to build a new area, if, you know, the supplies to get things to you, well, they're up in the grocery stores. That also means they're up when it comes to all those medical supplies getting to the doctors and the hospitals. So everything is feeding into this, and we just kind of run on this idea that I should just be given healthcare for free. And I always question people back, and I say, really? Do you really want to be treated by a doctor or a facility who's just doing it for free? They're not getting paid any extra for having gone to school or created a new procedure or, you know, a test, you know, that really gets in there and identifies and solves some major medical issue. There's no incentive. Like, is that truly what you want to be, you know, being taken care of by? We have to, you know.
Well, and of course, it's not practical either, because it's not free. Somebody has to be paid for something. I mean,
absolutely.
I always ask when I get those kinds of questions or lines of attack, I always ask them, do you work for free? And of course, the answer is no. So why would you honestly think that the services that are being rendered to you could somehow possibly be free?
It doesn't work that way. It sounds good, right? Doesn't it sound awesome as a quick soundbite?
Sure.
But that's not practical.
No.
It just isn't.
No, it really isn't. Okay, let's take a break a little bit early. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the root of all evil when it comes to healthcare money. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Lisa Lettmeyer. She is the owner of HealthSource NW, an independent insurance agency. Her specialty is to help individuals and businesses make sure they have the right coverage for when, God forbid, they actually need it. And we're continuing our discussion of the many crises in healthcare. You can find last week's discussion on iSpyRadio.com. This week, we're going to be focusing on the root of so many problems within healthcare, the money aspects. And so speaking of that, Lisa, why don't you remind our audience of what insurance used to look like and how we used to pay for things way back in the day before Obamacare?
Well, Obamacare really mainly affected, as far as how policies were issued, the individual market. So prior to Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act going into place in 2014, if you were applying for an insurance policy, you could apply anytime you wanted throughout the year. It didn't matter, but you did have to go through a qualification process. Now, that being said, we have 50 states that all have their own insurance division, and so that qualification could look different. So I can speak to here in Oregon. Oregon would take you through, each carrier had to go through the same roughly 55 health questions. Those only went back 5 years, so you didn't have to answer anything beyond 5 years. They could pull your medical records, they could review your medications, and then from that, they would decide if they could accept you into their risk pool or not. Now, here in Oregon, if you were declined because you didn't, you know, qualify, we had what's known as a high-risk pool. And it was actually managed by Regions Blue Cross, and that's where people who had been declined could go. The premiums there typically average, I believe it was 20 to 25% higher than the, you know, a typical plan would be in the direct market that you would have qualified for the obvious reason that there was something happening. You were at a higher risk of healthcare costs. The carriers actually helped to fund that pool because the premiums alone didn't support all of the claims for those group of people. So as a carrier, depending on how big your book of business was in the state, you paid kind of like a pro rata, I guess you could call it a tax, into that high-risk pool to help offset those costs. So that was how we managed it. What changed significantly with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare was going forward in 2014, the carriers could no longer ask any medical questions and do it a review, basically what we call in the industry guaranteed status. So no matter what's going on in your health history, they have to accept you. So there's no risk assessment at all, which for an insurance doesn't work very well. Insurance is designed using risk assessments. You pay based upon your risk. And so the only things that carriers can ask here in Oregon is, how old are you, and if you're a smoker or non-smoker, and what zip code you live in. So we definitely have different rates around the state based upon the cost of the networks and access to care. Obviously, the obvious one, smoker versus non-smoker, and then your age. So those are the only three factors the carrier can use. to try to protect the carriers from people waiting, of course, until they needed coverage, right, which is something that people do do.
Right.
The government defined it down to a specific enrollment period every year. We call it the open enrollment period. It opens November 1st and closes December 15th with an effective date of January 1. So you can either buy into the market at that time or change your plan for the following year if you want to make some changes. Outside of that, the only people technically who should be allowed to enroll in a plan is if you're having a qualifying event. So you've gotten married, divorced, there was a birth or an adoption, you've moved out of your service area or out of the state or into the state, you've lost employer-based coverage, and you have to prove that, which makes sense. And then on top of that, of course, was the subsidies that were designed, the government, you know, subsidies, which is taxpayer dollars, to help bring down the premium costs for people that were considered in lower income brackets. So that's the biggest change. They also was some changes that went through on what policies had to have across the nation. So there's an essential health care list that all policies must have. You did see some big varieties, variables across the nation as to what states would require or not require. They might make, for example, maternity care might be a rider. Drug abuse might be a rider. There's just different things that either were embedded or not embedded, depending on what state, even sure. Mental health. So it kind of was a way to flatten it out.
I remember one of the other issues had to deal with the size of companies and the number of full-time employees they had. And I remember having a conversation with a lady. She was the manager of a gas station, and she had had her hours cut way back. And it was because that if she was full-time, they'd have to pay for health insurance, and the company just couldn't afford that. And so in order to make ends meet, she actually had to get a second job to make up the hours because they cut her back to like 25 hours because they were deathly afraid that she'd... And remember also Obamacare lowered the number of hours that counted as full-time. I think it went down to 32 if I remember right. So they cut her back to 25 just to make sure that there was no way she was going to be kicked into full-time classification. So she had to do two jobs, and at which neither of which she was getting health care.
Right, and we still see that. So yeah, so the government kind of more at an employer group, especially large employer group, the government forced the employers to cover all employees. And it was what's considered a full-time employee. And they actually, in the calculation, add in your part-time and full-time and do this very complicated compilation of who's considered. And then depending on where that falls, you have to offer it. At the smaller group level, you can still define it. Like, for example, here in Oregon, you can still say, well, if you're an employee working X amount of hours, then you're eligible. If you're below this hour level, you're not. And that was what happened before. But at the national level, for the larger employers, it was more of forcing them to cover people. And if they didn't, they were penalized. And how they would catch it is if that same individual went and got an individual health plan on the exchange and received subsidies, then if that was the case and they were working for a large employer and the government did the calculation and said, yep, you should have offered them a coverage, and the employer got penalized. And it just really, it takes any kind of free market thinking out of it, as mm-hmm. you were talking about in your first segment. The reality is, I think, in the employer world, number one, it is interesting that it was, 1943, I think we talked about, that during the World War II, where because companies couldn't give you a higher wage or raise prices because of the war, they started giving these benefit packages, which weren't, they were tax deductible at the employer level, they weren't taxed at the employee level, and now we just assume it. We just, you know, expect it.
Right.
And that's a pretty personal insurance that you're relying on a company to give you. But on top of that, you know, the reality is, even in today's world, if you want to work for a company and it's a career and you want to be paid X, that's a negotiating thing. But when it's forced, it just kind of takes away that free market.
Right.
You know, companies should be out there vying for clients and vying for employees right way.
It absolutely
and
takes
are
yeah.
bad.
Yeah, I was just gonna say it absolutely takes the decision out of the consumer's hands. If you're getting a $50,000 salary and then $25,000 of benefit on top of that, you're being taxed at that $50,000 level. But wouldn't it be nice to have that extra $25,000 and then let the consumer decide whether or not something has value within the healthcare market as to whether or not they really want to pursue that? Okay, let's go and take a break. It's not just the businesses, but insurance companies as well that have suffered through all of this. Stay with us. More with Lisa Lettmeyer. panel. Now we're talking about the many crises of the healthcare system. We're doing that with Lisa Lettmeyer. It's a continuation of last week's show, which you can catch on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for, on the right-hand side, you'll see last week's show is part one. You can listen to that on the podcast version. And this week, we're focusing more on the money side of things. And so, Lisa, going on to that last segment there, I was talking about how it's not just businesses that had to deal with all of these Obamacare changes, but also the insurance companies themselves. And going into Obamacare, of course, it was, oh, these evil insurance companies, look at all the money they're making. Oh, my gosh. And of course, you know, but on the other side, you had a whole bunch of insurance companies jumping in on this because they were being told, oh, we're going to have access to millions of more customers as well. And so we're going to make more money than ever. So what's the reality of how this has all hit the insurance industries post Obamacare?
Well, the first thing to talk about is that one of the, again, within the Affordable Care Act, which is a monster piece of legislation, mm-hmm. like 3,000 mm-hmm. pages, but within that was this requirement that as an insurance company, and it's a slightly different for individual health plans versus group health plans, but the carrier themselves has to spend anywhere from 80 to 85% of all monies collected in premiums on claims, which means they're running the rest of the company, you know, the employees and the marketing and taxes and commissions to us agents, all of that, out of that remaining 15 to 20%. And I'm sure some people over there, that's great. And it's like, well, is it? Because that's an expensive endeavor, right? And all the mm-hmm. administration costs and all those things. So, you know, again, that's taking away that free market idea. And I'm a huge proponent of, if a carrier does good customer service and good payments, and you're going to hear that, you're going to see that, they're going to collect more people who want their coverage. If they're doing a bad job at that, people are going to leave them. So, you know, you've got to balance that out. And obviously, pre-Obamacare, you have to go through qualifications. So there's an issue with that. But two things. You know, kind of finishing up on that qualification thing, the whole piece of Obamacare was if you didn't get yourself enrolled in a health plan or have it through the employer, you were penalized on your taxes as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of that penalty was never significant enough to really motivate most people. And then it was actually removed. So there is still a requirement that you have health coverage, but there is no penalty that you pay for not having it. So we now do have a situation where people typically will buy plans certainly when they need it and may let it go if they think they're healthy and happy. So the carriers aren't doing as well. One of the other ideas in the original Obamacare, especially within the first few years, knowing that there was going to be some pent-up demand for health care and the carriers could be at risk, is the government had created or kind of the idea of, I guess you could call it a slush fund. So any carrier who suffered bigger losses than others could pull money from this fund to make them whole. We have an example of that here in our state. When we went into 2014, none of the carriers know what they're going to post in rates, right? Their competition until it's all posted and then becomes public knowledge. And so no matter what, one carrier is going to end up with the lowest rates. And we saw that happen. Moda Health had very, very attractive rates in 2014. So attractive that they kind of, at least in the individual market, kind of consumed the majority of the enrollments that first season. Well, they also suffered massive losses. Off the top of my head, and it's been a while since I've looked at these numbers, I want to say that their net loss that year for that book of business was somewhere in the area of $80 million. And they said, that's okay, because the government said that they've got this, you know, pool of money to make us whole. Well, that didn't come to fruition, because technically the pool of money was supposed to be any carriers who did well and had excess funds would put a percentage of those excess funds into the pool, therefore allowing for carriers who took a bigger loss to pull from it. Well, nobody had a lot of excess funds that year. In fact, again, this is pulling from my memory, but I think what Moda was able to get theoretically up front was like 12 cents on the dollar for their loss.
Ouch.
They and several other carriers across the nation filed a lawsuit against the federal government, and it actually just came to fruition earlier this year that they won. I don't know a lot about the trial, but it took that long, but they did win. The courts agreed that they were told that they'd be made whole, and that has to happen. But, you know, when we look at these carriers, it's not a huge money-making deal. In fact, if you really pay attention, most of our carriers, at least here in the Oregon, are not for profit. It's not what people think it is. As far as just, you know, oodles and oodles of money, these carriers have to carry financial reserves to basically be able to pay any claims that come up. And that's one of the things that are looked at on an annual basis at the state level. Our state insurance division has a very huge oversight on the rates. The rates are filed, and it's the insurance division who determines if those rates are appropriate, if they're too high, too low. So I've actually seen the division sometimes increase a carrier's rate request because they said, hey, we think you're kind of undercutting it, and you won't have enough money to pay claims. Mm. So that's what's really happening. It's not what the perceived is out there in the world.
Wow. A lot to unpack there. In terms of the government having oversight like that, it is kind of interesting that they'll tell an insurer, hey, you need to increase rates. But overall, doesn't it still just boil down to price controls?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, if you're an insurance carrier, and this is any insurance product, not just health, you're going to file your rate with your state's insurance division. Here in Oregon, I know exactly how it works with regards to the fact that you file those rates. The state has their own actuary team who reviews your information as to what your current claims have been, what your projected claims are based upon your book of business. And then you're saying, hey, this is the rates we feel that we need to charge to support this book. And the state has to look at it and agree with you. Or they can disagree and adjust that rate. So many times they'll kick it down a little bit or leave it the same. But I have actually seen on occasion that they'll say, we think that's a little bit low. We think that you're undercutting it. But there's a perception out there with consumers that there's no oversight, that these guys just, you know, throw a dart at the wall and decide what they want to charge. And that's not the case at all, especially given the fact that within the Affordable Care Act, again, the carriers are required to spend anywhere from 80% to 85% of all of their premiums collected on claims.
Well, I guess
a lot of oversight.
Yeah, I just look at that and I'm thinking, you know, sometimes you do want to undercut and underbid because you're trying to attract new customers. I mean, it's really up to that company's decision. And then hopefully they have penciled things out correctly, but because if they haven't, they're certainly going to adjust the next year. All right, this is really interesting. Let's continue this thought. Coming back, we'll have more with Lisa Lentmeyer talking about the insurance issues that is driving so much within healthcare. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Lisa Lentmeyer. It's continuing our discussion from last week about the many crises going on within healthcare. And today we're focusing in on insurance and the money aspect of things. So Lisa, going on to that last segment there, it was really a fascinating discussion in terms of how the interaction between the government is effectively setting some of these prices and putting, you know, with these own controls in. And my producer was listening to that. And she says, you know, as she hears it, it's almost like these companies aren't their own companies, they're effectively an arm of the government. Is that an accurate way to describe that?
You know, I would, to the extent of this. With the passing of the Affordable Care Act, you have a massive piece of federal legislation that dictates to both the, you know, large employer-based health plans and individual-based health plans, you know, what they have to cover, how much they have to cover, and how they have to issue policies. There's huge oversight and rules and regulations on how the documents that are submitted for the consumer to review, whether it's the enrollment form or it's the summary of benefits or the explanation of benefits, which is like a deep dive, all of that is regulated and has to be approved, whether it be at the state or federal level, depending on what type of insurance you're discussing. So they're not just out there, again, doing what they want. They're beholden either to the state or Fed or a combination thereof in regulation. One good example of that is, as we were talking during the break, is that pre-Obamacare, most of our policies here in Oregon would actually show in the summary of benefits that the maximum amount that they would pay out in the course of a lifetime of a consumer that was insured with them was $2 million. And back in the day, that was a pretty safe bet. Like, I mean, you were pretty well protected. But now, with the passing of Obamacare, there is no lifetime limit. It's not allowed. Mm. So that carrier, as they take you on, especially in the individual market without any risk assessment at all, they are taking on an unknown uncapped risk. And then on top of that, and this is where this is my personal opinion, but again, insurance was designed to protect us against those unknown tragedies right. of a significant illness or injury. But we're now trying to add in a lot more. If we're not able to get pregnant, we want the policy to pay for our fertility treatments. If we're not happy with who we are, we want, you know, our stomach stapled, or we want to be changed to a different gender. And these are things that we, you know, somebody I'm sure would argue, well, that's important to my happiness and health. But I would argue back, that's not going to prevent you from living and breathing, right? You're not getting your stomach stapled, or you're not having the baby that you want, and it's heartbreaking. But that doesn't prevent you from moving on in life. And we need to remember that insurance was designed, at least health insurance initially was designed, to really cover those extreme costs in those extreme cases for life, you know, your health. They're really not out there on their own doing whatever they want. They are under heavy, heavy regulation.
Yeah, and, you know, it kind of gets back to what we finished last week's show with, is that, you know, this is really a societal change where society just doesn't say no anymore, and we now demand that of our insurance companies as well. So can insurance companies, I mean, do they have the ability to say no? If somebody walks into a doctor's office and says, I want a third arm coming out of the top of my head, are they able to say no?
I mean, they do still have a policy design. There is, you know, this is what we can, you know, cover, but it's all based off of, again, that essential health list. So, and that's at the federal level. So what the government says, you've got to cover at least these things. That's a requirement. And on top of the federal health essentials list, each state can still impose additional requirements that need to be covered. So, for example, in Washington and now in Oregon, there's a requirement for embedded alternative care. So that's not part of the national essential health list, but that's a state-specific. So there is some definitions there. I mean, you know, people can't just do whatever they want. But what we are seeing is more and more things included in that policy. And a lot of times it's being driven by either state or federal regulation.
Well, and certainly given the current trajectory, I don't see that getting any better in terms of being able to say no on these things. So Obamacare was one of the big selling points they sold to Democrats and to, of course, none of the Republicans actually voted for it. But here in Oregon, that was Oregon's grand healthcare transformation. It was packaged and sold to Republicans who did vote for it. Some of them did. Some of the doofuses out there. So it was going to save all of this money. So what happened? Why did the savings never materialize that they thought was going to happen?
Well, I mean, at the beginning of it, the idea is if we get everybody insured, we don't have people showing up at a hospital having major procedures, you know, things that should have been taken care of sooner, and then not getting paid, right? So part of Obamacare was expanding Medicaid. Now, not all the states picked that up. I think initially 30 to 35 states did that. So what that means is that it's easier to qualify for Medicaid assistance. And so those people that are covered are now, in theory, getting care when they need it, and then hopefully not showing up at the ER with unpaid bills. So that was supposed to be a savings area, really, for the providers, but also the carriers with regards to unpaid bills. But on top of that, what you have to consider is that if you have somebody who walks into a hospital or a doctor's office who's on Medicaid or Medicare, the rate that the provider's getting paid weren't negotiated. They were just given to them by the state or the feds. It wasn't like a back and forth negotiation of the doctor saying, I want this, and the Medicaid and Medicare saying, oh, well, how about this? And they go back and forth. It's literally dictated every year what these providers get, which is going to be lower than the standard rate that they would get for a patient who is through private insurance. And so as they look at their base of people, when they're losing money or getting underpaid on a group of people, they have to make that up elsewhere. So those providers will then increase their negotiated rate with the insurance carriers for all the private pay people. So as you increase the amount of people on the government programs, which is underpaying providers, that has to go somewhere. It doesn't just disappear, and it gets squeezed over to higher rates that the insurance carriers must pay to keep providers in network. And the providers are required, whether it's at a health insurance level, individual or group health, or even Medicare level, they have to keep a certain amount of providers and hospital access within a given area, and if they can't support that network, they can't sell in that area. So they're really kind of at the mercy of this because they've got to keep paying the providers higher and higher. I mean, it's so complicated that for people to just make this arbitrary, you know, healthcare should be free and these carriers just charge too much. It's like, really? Yeah. Do you not understand what's going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, it is.
And most people don't.
No, they don't. And it is just such a mess. All right, everyone stay with us. We'll wrap things up with Lisa Lettmeyer. And we're back in our final segment now with Lisa Lettmeyer. She's the owner of HealthSource Northwest. You can find her at healthsourcenw.com, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And Lisa, you know, just kind of replaying everything that we've been talking about this week and last with the price controls, the government interfering with transactions, the bureaucratic stranglehold on everything, you know, I can just see why people in the medical field, they're just so busy responding to things, they don't innovate, which would normally lower prices and everything. And you look at the entire system and you just kind of have to wonder, did they design it to fail? Or from a socialist slash Marxist standpoint, is that just a happy accident, a natural result of everything else they've done?
You know, I wish I had the answer to that, truly. I mean, sometimes when I look at this, I feel like they purposely set it up to fail. But then on the other hand, I look at it and go, or did they just want that quick vote?
Yeah.
We can talk about our healthcare system, which would include Medicare, Medicaid, and these are political footballs. Nobody ever wants to have a real discussion with the American people and say, hey, folks, here's the numbers, right? Like, for example, Medicare was started in 1965, and right now we're in the middle of the baby boomers becoming Medicare eligible.
Yep.
That's a huge push on the system of at the same time, those people are leaving the market where they're paying taxes into it. We've increased the number of people on Medicaid. I looked it up recently, just last week, actually, based upon some discussions, and apparently in our country, we're sitting at a population of about 332 million people as of January of 2022. Of that, 85 million are on Medicaid right now. And for you guys in the listening audience, that's 26% of our country on Medicaid. Now, some of that is because while we went into the pandemic and we have the Medicaid program, we didn't want to have people, or the government didn't want to have people recertifying to stay on Medicaid. So they have basically put that on hold. Normally you would recertify every year. So there's this glutton of people that haven't recertified that are still on it. We expanded the subsidies. So people who are getting individual health coverage are getting it at a much, much lower rate. If those subsidies don't get extended at the end of the year, we're going to see a huge increase in some of the people's premiums. That doesn't do good when you're heading into the midterm elections. There's so many different things. Even the subsidies themselves, and you and I have talked about this before, when you're applying for financial assistance through the federal exchange or your state-based exchange, depending on where you live, you're basically stating, here's my current month income, my estimated next month income, and my estimated income for the next year. And the first thing that they look at when they look at your current month income or next month income is, are you Medicaid eligible? And if you are, everything stops there. You're on Medicaid. If you go beyond that because you don't qualify for Medicaid and you're looking at the year, they look at your yearly income, and then they determine if you're eligible for subsidies. It used to be you were only eligible if you were below 400% of the poverty mark. Now they took the limit off. So you might not get as much subsidy, but everybody's eligible for subsidy regardless of their income status versus poverty. And nowhere in any of those questions or calculations is asset testing. So you could have somebody who's living off of retirement incomes, they've got a fully paid off home, and they're just pulling their investment income, the interest. And so on paper, they look like they're not making any money at all. But if you looked at their assets, they're doing quite well. But the subsidies and the, you know, both for Medicaid and for subsidies, they do not ask those questions. So that's a concern.
Why don't they look at that? That would just seem to be common sense that you look at that.
Well, like you said, is this designed to fail to get us to a one pay system, which everybody's, you know, not everybody, but some people think would be a magical place to be? Or is it because they want to vote at that point in time in that year? I think it's a little bit of both. I think that they definitely have a plan to move us to universal health care, but at the same time, I think that sadly, our legislature at the federal level and even at the state level truly makes decisions and passes taxes and new programs and everything based upon getting a vote. It's a very short-term look at things. It's not a long-term look. But man, does it look good on those, you know, commercials when you're trying to rally and get those votes because the other side's evil.
Well, speaking of votes,
that's not how we should be conducting the country.
No, absolutely not. So speaking of votes, if you were to advise somebody running for office right now, what would be the one fix that you would say, you know, to really have a big bang for the buck here, what would you suggest for them? And we only got about a minute here with you.
I don't know that there's one thing. I mean, again, I would put in tort reform. I would, quite frankly, put limits on advertising for medications. You know, we talked about it, the Medicaid and subsidies. I'd put asset tests in. I mean, there's so many things I would do. I'd start looking at the education programs and making college more affordable. There's so many things.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Lisa, we'll have to have you back because I guarantee this is not going to be fixed by next year.
No. Sadly, no.
Yep. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I had asked Lisa about breaking the system. Personally, I do think the destruction is on purpose, and most progressives want our system to be like the nationalized healthcare they have over in the UK. Well, here's a little picture of what that would look like. It's a tweet from someone over there. My cousin had to deliver his child because the ambulance said they'd take 4.5 hours to come for his wife. What is the UK coming to? He had to watch a YouTube tutorial on how to deliver a baby. Well, there you go. Let's spend hundreds of billions of dollars more to become that. You know, it was a bit unfair of me to spring that on Lisa. You've only got a minute to solve healthcare. But just to add to what she said, here's a simple one. Get politicians to focus on getting back to a free market system. Get government out of healthcare. Politicians need to define and explain how they will focus on repealing government regulations and backing away from total control over healthcare, period. Until we get government out of healthcare, we will never fix healthcare. And that's really the thing. If you think government is the answer to government causing problems in any industry, that's just going to lead to more problems. It's untangling government from an industry that solves problems, especially when it's government that caused the problems to begin with. Get politicians to focus on that. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.